This is Tech for Breakfast, and this episode features Mai Ichikawa Sutton, a digital activist, organizer for all things digital policy, and she's here to help us continue the discussion around net neutrality.
You're tuning in to another episode of Houston Tech Talks podcast, also Tech for Breakfast. And today we have, I'll let you introduce yourself.
Okay.
All right. So tell us your name, your background, who you are, and why you're the best person for what you're doing.
Hi. So I'm Mai Ichikawa Sutton. I'm a digital organizer, writer, community activist and solidarity economy fan. And so I'm originally from Pasadena, California, grew up there and ended up going to UC Santa Cruz, where I worked on social justice and technology for undergrads and for nonprofits around the Bay Area and the US and around the world. Then worked and lived in Malaysia for a while, working with Muslim feminists and helping them with their tech needs, doing databasing and all that. Then eventually went on to move to San Francisco, and I worked on tech policy for 5 years. And I did international intellectual property activism, essentially thinking about intellectual property, primarily copyright, and how copyright promotes or prevents people from sharing information and knowledge and creativity. And I was doing that for a while and sort of decided that there needed to be more sort of heart and connection and human dialogue and democracy in technology, and you know what the point and the purpose of innovation is, tech innovation. So I left that and went into an organization called Shareable that writes about the solidarity economy and all facets of that, including community gardens, libraries, you know, blockchain-based distributed innovation and value. And then lately I've been doing freelance writing and community organizing and sort of trying to build a community internet in Oakland. So that's the,
So you do a lot.
Yeah.
Can you tell, can you talk more about like what the solidarity economy is, and like for people who might not know?
So the solidarity economy has many names. There's also like the post-capitalist organizing or movement to the there are many alternatives framing versus the there's only one alternative or there is no alternative, the TINA model of things. And the solidarity economy is just basically, it's core is that people working together to provide the things that they need for themselves and governing it together democratically. And you know, I think there's various types of people that would think of it in different ways, but to me, solidarity economy will only flourish if we talk to each other, if we understand and respect each other, and identify, you know, what it means to be human, which is, you know, to survive and thrive together. And I think recognize in our individual passions and our strengths and seeing how we fit into how we work in a society. And it's sort of a counter movement, I guess, to what we see today, which is an economic system that's based upon, you know, us being sort of cogs in a machine that's out of our control. That we are innovating and making things that we don't necessarily need because there's certain people that just want to make more money.
Have the money to do it, so let's just do it.
So that's like the very short version is like it's an economic system based upon solidarity.
Cool.
As the name suggests.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. So thinking about, You've been in these different spaces, kind of jumped around, got to see a lot. Kind of wondering what you feel has been the biggest challenge, or like what was the biggest hurdle for you to overcome as you progress through these different spaces?
You mean personally, right?
Personally, or just I wouldn't call it professionally, but like kind of in your plight, in your path, what's been some of the most difficult things, or what was something that in overcoming it was the biggest step for you?
I think, you know, as a woman and Asian American woman, I have come across a lot of people who don't take me seriously, mm-hmm. or like, yeah, who sort of ignore what I'm saying, or don't, you know, sort of assume things about my role or my opinions. And that's been something that I continue to come across today. And I think I've dealt with that is sort of like, I'm going to think like a white dude and really just sort of like act like I know what I'm doing sometimes, yeah. and also just be really assertive.
Yeah.
And not like bulldoze people, but like
right.
just be like, this is my opinion. And I think, you know, it's valid and not sort of waver from that.
Mm.
And I think like along with that is imposter syndrome, right? Because I think when people have more self-awareness and they actually care about other people and they like are aware of like, you know, maybe their lack of experience or their or you know what they say, that the more you know, the more you know what you don't know.
Yeah.
And so I feel like that is something that I've dealt with. And I think like, you know, a lot of my friends who are women and people of color, I think like a thing is that sort of getting over that sort of like hurdle of like feeling like you aren't the right person for the job or like that you don't know enough. I think so many people, and it's not sort of said in a lot of ways, but a lot of people just read and then they talk to people and they just sort of try it and they keep trying until they fail they fail until they succeed.
Right.
And I think like I think people, especially like women, people of color, and people who, and lower income people as well, like when you don't have a support structure or society telling you that you are meant to succeed, you don't feel like it in this, you don't feel entitled to it in the same way. And so I think that's like sort of a personal thing, but I think like in terms of the bridge between the tech economy, the solidarity economy thing, that I think I'm recognizing is sort of like two-pronged, which is one side is that I think our negotiating muscles, like our ability to talk to each other and make decisions together, is so weak that it's really hard to do that. And I think that's like the prerequisite for us to build technology that meets our needs and, you know, that we can identify problems that we actually want to solve, that we need to solve. And I think like talking about it and making decisions is like the first step in that.
For sure.
And really quickly, the second one is that, you know, the capital to fund things that actually solve, you know, high need issues, I think is another challenge, especially in thinking about, you know, the purpose and the point of technology and like what kind of problems that we're trying to solve. Are we trying to solve like how slow it takes to make coffee and, you know, like whether, you know, a lot of people have dogs and don't have people to walk them, or, you know, like, are we trying to solve like poverty and, you know, lack of access to resources? So I think like the capital issues is a major one.
Yeah, for sure. Let's see. I had a revised version of these questions for you. I wasn't able to find them, but
okay.
It's all good. I'm wondering, in your mind, like in my circle, kind of within Devland, a lot of the people that we work with, we talk about 2025 a lot. The year 2025, not necessarily because it's some like ideal year or it has some historical value or anything of that nature. It is the quarter of the century, and it has been a kind of a marker milestone in previous centuries for how people are progressing and how things are changing in a certain pattern. And so my question is kind of around, it's not that far in the future, but it's far enough away that things could change drastically. Kind of along the lines of your, maybe your personal insights and then like the work that you're doing and what you're passionate about, what does 2025 look like for you?
You mean my hopes or the, my dystopian, like
manifest it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think, so that's like, you know, from today, 7 years away, technology evolves so fast, even within a year. And I think in 7 years, a lot of the current trends that we see around like, Internet of Things, so things surrounding us that are internet enabled, to algorithms deciding what we see and how we see information, to how, in light of the net neutrality loss, I guess, from last year in the United States, how the ISPs, the internet service providers, and the people who control last mile infrastructure from, you know, the internet access point to your home, that those companies are consolidating and there's fewer and fewer players. I mean, there's already just a handful of players. And that I think all of those things, I mean, I haven't talked about all of the technologies, but I feel like as along with the general trend in the United States, how power continues to consolidate at the top. I think there's, I think more and more people will see the problems with that. I think just within the last, you know, week or so around Facebook and the Cambridge Analytica controversy, like recognizing that we just can't trust large tech companies with our data and to control how we talk to each other and how we live our lives. And I think there's going to be more of these massive controversies around technology. And I think there've already been a lot, but I think the repercussions of them will be felt more strongly because the technologies and like are so pervasive in our life, like how we do anything is, you know, everything is going to be controlled more and more. And so as sort of, you know, that's the dystopian side of it. But I think I think in any crisis, there's an opportunity to build things that are better and to see, because crises really put to the fore what is the problem with the current system and the current ways of things. So I think projects like the one that I'm working on, which is to enable people to control how they connect to their neighbors and their family and their community, by, you know, having hopefully like free software, Wi-Fi routers that enable them to mesh with their neighbors and then, you know, pick up any bandwidth that that's available, to actually just have local internet services like a community calendar or wiki or local news or bulletin, like a Craigslist. I think that's like one example of a digital commons, like as we would, you know, like to have more parks or, you know, clean water and clean air, these things that we share as humans and, you know, with nature. To have these sort of resources that are digital, that are tech enabled, but what it really does is enable us to connect and to share the information, culture, you know, relationships that are built on these technologies, and to hopefully make sure that we have control over them in a really transparent way. And I think, and I hope that in the next 7 years that this discussion will continue to pick up steam as, you know, people get more freaked out about technology, watching Black Mirror and just recognizing all the news that happens out there. So I think a re-emboldened conversation around, like, what does it mean for technology to actually be to work for us, you know, and understanding that is not just about building a product, but it's like actually the system, the process to build these products, to build these technologies is as important, if not much more important than the actual product itself.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's big. Super big.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that, and you picked up a lot of notes that I kind of want to backtrack on. Just the idea of digital commons, dealing with the repeal of net neutrality and kind of what that sets society up for at the moment. Looking at this opportunity we have to really educate people on what the internet actually is, because there's definitely a very naive and ignorant depiction of what it is and how it behaves, and which in my opinion sets up the stage for how it's accessed or the kind of the perspective people have around how it's utilized. Just this idea of solving problems that are of high need and impact versus things that are of social convenience or luxury appetite. And I kind of want to start with the net neutrality piece. We recently did an interview with Nathan Murthy from Tesla, who spoke a little bit about the work that he's doing in these different coding community organizations to give back, but also kind of what his perspective is on net neutrality and access and all these things. I kind of just want to ask around the question. I'm of the personal opinion that guidelines from the FCC are not a legitimate means to shift culture, to do things in a certain way. And even with their presence, we can observe the idea that the consolidation of power, as you mentioned, was very prevalent, allowing companies like Comcast and Clear Channel and AT&T and other large entities to control access points to backbone infrastructure in a way that people on the ground no longer have analog telephones. They can't communicate with their local community very readily and now are locked into an internet-only world. What is your opinion more so on net neutrality and kind of is it the guidelines set for us that are more important, or kind of what can we do in the community to start to become more aware and make decisions to, you know, bridge the gap?
Yeah, I think I agree with you that giving a federal agency the power to regulate the tubes, I guess, for lack of a better term, is, you know, not a way to empower people to think and rethink about what the internet means and how they connect with, you know, with other people in their community. I think it would have been great if net neutrality protections did pass. I think it would have just sort of kicked the can down the road in some ways. But I think, working on a community wireless network project here in Oakland, I think the fact that net neutrality was sort of unraveled does provide, again, like another crisis opportunity for us to invite people to rethink what it means to have an internet that is actually, you know, controlled by them.
Right.
And I think, relegating that decision sort of to a federal agency, I think sort of was a, not a cop out, but it is sort of a way to sort of give agency to somebody else and not to think about how personally you can have your own agency in how you build the internet.
Yeah.
I sort of, you know, thought about this a lot after the Obama presidency, but how a lot of people, I think, were like, oh, Obama's amazing. He's going to solve everything for us. And then, you know, how that went.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think that that similar sort of dynamic was sort of playing out with the net neutrality fight. Like, oh, if we just give the FCC the right tools and we give them the power to, you know, clamp down on these ISPs, then our internet will be saved. And that's obviously not true.
Right.
And yeah, and I think now there is an opportunity, and there's already many projects that are emerging from that opening. I mean, yeah, even before the net neutrality debate. And I think, like, it's not because it's not that our technology needs to be really advanced for us to build an alternative internet.
No, not at all.
At all. It's actually like a people problem. It's like, we just need to, you know, talk to our neighbors. We need to think about, you know, maybe be a little bit more technical ourselves. You know, we're all capable of doing some of this, you know, this stuff. I think, you know, it's I think it's a challenge of relationships and lack of relationships and time and bandwidth, pun intended, for us to be able to work on, you know, the alternative internet issue.
Yeah. No, I think we're really stumbling into a time where everything we believed about innovation in society is now like knocking on the door and saying, hey, what do you want to do about this? Like, I remember growing up and having folks come together to host LAN parties, to play video games, and walking down the street to their friend's house with a computer tower and nerding out. You know, there's this idea of connecting your computers together that in that example makes a lot of sense to a few folks. But for the mass majority, I don't really think that people realize that a lot of previously used telecom systems have been deprecated and replaced by internet-based protocol systems. So now we live in a locked world that, you know, I can't talk to you if I don't have an LTE signal on my phone or internet access is problematic in the case of a natural disaster, catastrophe, things of that, you know, that level. And then just on a regular means of just communicating, like you said, like the opportunity to communicate locally information is being overstepped. And, you know, I'm kind of wondering what you feel about, kind of lost my piece. I'm kind of wondering what you feel about, just this idea of connectivity now that the internet is our only, or is the mass platform for people to connect.
What do I think about the connection, the relationships based upon how the internet is?
Yeah, the dependency more so. Oh, dependency. What do you think about the dependency now that the internet is being utilized in the way it is?
Yeah, I think it's,
and maybe you can bring a policy kind of perspective into that too.
Yeah. I think it's, extremely problematic, not just because of the, you know, monopoly control over that last mile infrastructure of the ISPs being so few and so powerful, but also just the, you know, the concentration of our attention on fewer and fewer platforms themselves, like on Facebook and Google and Instagram, Snapchat, and it's sort of these like islands.
Yeah.
It's like the balkanization of our internet world versus like something that was, you know, in the early internet days, even like just this beautiful chaos of like all these websites and apps and, you know, obviously that had problems as well, but it was much more organic and sort of fluid and open to innovation in a way that I don't think it is now. And I think more broadly than that, like, you know, as I would sort of consider myself an older, on the older side of a millennial, but you know, when somebody just cold calls me on my phone, for instance, I'm like, oh my God, are they dying? Because like people don't call each other anymore. And you know, I don't have a landline at home, and but every time I do have a good conversation on the phone, I actually am like, yeah, like why don't I just talk to people on the phone more, right? I think that concentration of interaction on these, on the internet, I think is problematic because of the way that the platforms and the infrastructure itself is controlled. But I think it also limits how we interact with each other. You know, it would be awesome if we all knew how to operate like low power radios or like, you know, anything else, like had more like bulletin, community bulletin boards, even like, you know, just old, like very, very like basic stuff. And I think like the loss of how both like the way that our communication is controlled and how also, I mean, as we've found with the whole Facebook controversy, that the data that's being collected on us, that is being used to, you know, in very nefarious ways, to sell us things we don't want, or even worse, to like change political outcomes and democracy. I think like there needs to be a whole other, there needs to be a reopening of how we communicate in a way that's transparent, that's privacy respecting, that empowers people to talk versus like, you know, being used to divide us into like little data, you know, I don't know, like we're cows being milked of our data, you know? So, yeah, having communication that empowers us, I think is like the main point. And we don't have that.
Yeah. There's another current issue that's more about how, because computers are transmitting our information, it's being cached in all these different places. And in the UK, citizens have the ability to erase themselves from the internet, whereas in the United States we don't currently have that opportunity. And then also just how people view data as a asset of ownership to the person is not necessarily coherent at this point as well. I recently kind of had a few discussions with some startups that are working in the blockchain space to really visit the idea of decentralizing the internet. And that's part of their proposition, is this idea that you own your data, have the rights to withdraw, encrypt, and determine who accesses that information, wherever it's stored. Where do we kind of, what is the outlook from an IP and like a monetization perspective, where you have companies like Facebook that their gold is your data, versus a world where, you know, we actually own our data and have the rights to control who uses it. You know, there's definitely some policy implications there, and also kind of just this third party involvement from the government in a way of having to enact how that's performed. So kind of wondering, like, what do you think about that concept of people owning their data and being able to control who accesses it and who's able to see it?
There are some great thinkers on this. I'm didn't really touch or like think about how our privacy could be, I guess, like, you know, IP protected. I think there's a lot of negative externalities if we, you know, sort of slap the IP model, like the copyright patent model, on other forms of information, just because I think the whole like idea that we lock down these things in ways that, I guess, create more like more legalities and more complications, I think, is really problematic. But having said that, I think, yeah, we definitely should have more control over our data and at least know what's out there. I mean, I think like the main first step is like knowing what about us is out there and who has it. And we don't even know that, right? And then, you know, sort of the next step to that is being able to give rights to people to use it for certain things. You know, I think, for instance, I think there's a lot of health information that is not being used in ways that could help us find all kinds of innovative uses or, I guess, patterns about how we live our lives and in the health, you know, the public health system. So there are certain things that maybe you'd like to give to certain people, like scientists or academic institutions, right? But then there's a lot of information that is exploited about, like, your what you like to buy, what you wear, your insecurities, what makes you happy, what makes you sad. Like, Facebook has, like, you know, the top scientists in the world trying to understand how you think and feel and what you want and need to exploit you, you know? And so that's extremely problematic. So I guess the another thing is to know, you know, what kinds of information they are or findings are finding from our information. And I think that's also something that we have no transparency about. So, you know, it's not... I'm going to sort of dodge the IP privacy question because I also just think it's a, you know, it just seems like a very bad idea. But, you know, I think like there are some intermediary like policy steps that really need to be made. I think you're right that in Europe, particularly in the UK, but in the European Union, there's, you know, a lot more data privacy protections there. For instance, I had an account with an academic research website that's based in Europe somewhere, and they were like, "You haven't used your account in you know 2 years or something, and if you don't respond to this, we're going to delete all your information." You know, and that's something that's great. You know, that's like even that's really basic, but we don't have any of that here. So, I think, like thinking about like what. Not just the implications of giving this information to these companies, but like them holding on to it forever. It's, you know, there's only one of you, of each of us. And our data is like a finger. It's even more identifying than a fingerprint, you know? And so what that means for security just and being able to rely on like our identities on the internet, it's like just so scary. So, there is one real quickly a human rights framework at the UN that my former colleague and friend actually Katitza Rodriguez at the Electronic Frontier Foundation developed with hundreds of lawyers and activists around the world to create 13 principles for privacy on the internet and I think that would be a great starting point to think about all the various kinds of things you need to weigh in terms of like our privacy on the internet.
A little bit in there when you're talking about like who we can potentially donor access to, I started to think about like being an organ donor on your license. Like, will we, you know, venture into a world where your data is something that you can donate to science or something like that? And potentially, but I thought that was interesting, kind of popped out of what you were talking about. Yeah, so that's a lot of what I had. I mean, we talked about a lot. let's see. Oh yeah, there's one question. What would you or what advice would you give to somebody who's just wandering around and they have like this there's like some cosmic energy saying that they should be following in a piece of your pathway. What advice would you give to them in kind of seeking out what it is that they should do and then how to get involved more so to have interest in, you know, some of the subject or domain that you discussed today?
I would say read a lot and go to talks, watch, you know, videos of people who are talking about these issues around the internet and communication and what it means for, you know, our societies to be able to share culture and information and identify problems together, like, and pursue, you know, maybe fellowships or jobs that that get you into those places where they're talking about that. Sometimes that means doing the exact job that, like, a organizing position, but sometimes it's just like, you know, being an administrator or something and starting to be around people who are talking about this stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think there's a lot of, especially here in Silicon Valley, a feeling that to work in tech, you have to be a technologist, you have to be a coder, and you have to, you know, have, you know, all kinds of years of experience to do this stuff. And that certainly helps. And I'm working on that sort of aspect of my, I don't know, like toolbox, I guess. But mm-hmm. I think we just, something that we need a lot of is people who are good at making organizing. And organizing is about spreading information, about talking to people, making connections, finding, you know, where people have energy, like time energy, or, you know, or money energy, mm-hmm. or, you know, power, I guess, and connecting those things so that things that are positive for the world can happen.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's, I think there's a lot of ways you can do that. You know, join any sort of nonprofit, do any sort of organizing, and learn how people talk to each other and how, you know, how you can help others help themselves. And mm-hmm. and so I think, like, not being afraid to enter, you know, tech activism, or even just like doing the startup world in businesses that you feel are positive. I think it's to really understand the problems first.
Mm.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for speaking with me today. I think that this was a very informative discussion, both short in duration, but just really saturated with a lot of different topics, words, vocabulary, and things of that nature that I would implore those listening to kind of get a pencil and pad out and write some of this stuff down and go travel on the internet to find a journey to those different meanings. But definitely for sure, thank you. And this is more of a continuation around the topic that we started in previous episodes around net neutrality, local internet, and access for all. So I'm sure that we'll do more around this subject, but for now, this is another episode of Houston Tech Talks podcast. Stay tuned, and also check in the Facebook group if you're interested. If you're listening on Tech for Breakfast, please look out for more episodes like this and tune in on our various channels, Facebook, Twitter, and otherwise. All right.